From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. There is a new war of words today between the United States and Russia. That is state-sponsored Russian TV reading a tweet written by President Trump this morning that said Moscow should get ready for a missile strike against Syria. The U.S. believes the Syrian government carried out a deadly chemical attack on its own people last Saturday. Russia backs the Syrian government. It says there is no evidence of a chemical attack. And now senior Russian officials have threatened to meet any U.S. airstrikes with their own military response. BBC Middle East editor Jeremy Bowen joins us now from London. And Jeremy, President Trump is ratcheting up the rhetoric with a tweet that seems like a schoolyard taunt, but with potentially major implications.
Yeah, it has major implications because he is the president of the United States and the commander-in-chief of a massive military force. So do we take it seriously or do we not? There's also been this morning the Russian ambassador in Lebanon saying that the Russians will deal with any missiles that come over, including trying to hit the sources of where those missiles may be coming from, which, you know, would that be a U.S. ship in the Mediterranean? I don't know. So there's a lot of big talk flying around at the moment, and clearly that is dangerous.
It is hard to know whether it's just bluster or actual threats. You know, Russia has also said that a U.S. airstrike would be a war crime, and that, as you say, it could respond by targeting U.S. naval ships. I mean, just play that scenario out for a moment. If Russia were to make good on that threat, what happens?
War. That's an act of war. I think you can argue that bombing Syria is also an act of war. But when the whole thing, if the whole thing means that the two big powers get involved, the Russians and the Americans, then that's the kind of war that is really, really serious for the entire stability and safety of the world. So let's hope it doesn't go that far and that these guys are simply venting a bit of steam at the moment. A Kremlin spokesman has said as well today he's tried to calm some oil on troubled waters and said let's hope that reason prevails. The chemical weapons inspectors from the OPCW, the international body that deals with these kinds of things, say that they are going to go in as soon as possible to try and make some inspections. Now, would the US and its allies, would the British, the French, would they be able to attack any targets when there are international inspectors working at those sites in the country?
Mm-hmm.
It would be very difficult. At the very least, it's a serious complication.
How do you think this escalating of tensions between Russia and the United States would affect support for a strike against Assad among France, among the United Kingdom?
Well, I think that if things started getting very difficult between the US and Russia, I think that the allies would probably tend to pull together. There are reports in the British press here in London saying that the Prime Minister, Theresa May, has said to Trump that she needs a bit more proof of what actually happened before Britain could get involved in a military sense. And you know, Britain hasn't got many assets in the area. They've got there's a big base in Cyprus, and they can fly planes out of that. But there aren't any submarines, I think, in the area, apparently, according to the newspapers. So, you know, the U.S. clearly, you know, it's got a carrier battle group in the Mediterranean. It's got one in the Gulf. It's got tremendously powerful and potent forces, and they can do more or less what they want in terms of hitting targets. The difficulty with all of this is what happens after that.
Mm.
What happens in terms of the other countries involved in Syria, which is already, if you like, a mini world war, and what happens to the wider picture of those very strained relations between the Kremlin and the White House.
Now, we also have to consider the growing conflict between Iran and Israel. Iran is saying that it is going to retaliate for an alleged Israeli strike earlier this week in Syria that killed several Iranian fighters. Israel has not confirmed that they're responsible for this. But now that simmering fight appears to be coming to a head.
I think one of the really worrying things going on is that tension between the Israelis and the Iranians. And the reason why I use that phrase mini world war to describe what's going on in Syria is that there are various countries involved there, including some of the most powerful military forces in the world, who are pursuing their different agendas in those places. For Iran, the agenda is, I think, establishing a pretty strong, much more permanent footprint in the country as, if you like, a reward for the way it's helped out Assad during the course of 7 years of fighting. The Israelis have said very clearly that's something they couldn't tolerate. So that's already a big difficulty. Factor into that that Hezbollah in Lebanon, big ally of Iran, has, one figure is more than 100,000 missiles pointed towards Israel. And the two countries there, the Israelis and Hezbollah, they talk about not whether or not there'll be another war, but the timing of it. You know, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. So let's hope that some of this stuff does calm down, because the potential for a conflagration is there.
That's the BBC's Middle East editor, Jeremy Bowen, in London. Jeremy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
There's another major disagreement between the U.S. and Russia over Crimea. Remember, for nearly 4 years, the U.S. and the EU have imposed sanctions on Russia over its annexation of Crimea and other actions in eastern Ukraine. The measures restrict travel, target assets of individuals linked to the Kremlin. But Ukraine officials say there's one major confidant of Russian President Putin who should be sanctioned and isn't. NPR's Soraya Sahardi-Nelson reports he's a former chancellor of Germany.
The man Ukrainians want punished is Gerhard Schröder. He is one of Germany's most loved and also most hated post-war leaders.
Nicht erreicht. 9 Uhr. Die Sitzung ist geschlossen.
After 7 years in office, he lost a no-confidence vote in parliament, and Angela Merkel's conservatives won the subsequent early elections. Schröder's political demise is linked to his painful overhaul of Germany's welfare and labor system. But German respect for the 73-year-old plummeted further over his ties to Russian business and his frequent praise in defense of Vladimir Putin. Omid Nuripur is an MP with the Green Party, which was part of Schröder's former coalition government.
The way Schröder is lobbying for Putin's positions in Germany is disgusting and is a huge contradiction to the oath he once gave to serve the German people and the German interests.
He shocked many Germans by shepherding through a multi-billion-dollar Russian-German gas pipeline during his final months as chancellor, and then became the venture's board chairman shortly after leaving office. Other controversial appointments linked to Russian interests followed. Last year, Schröder was elected chairman of the board of Russia's largest oil company, Rosneft. It's a posting businessman Wolfgang Büchele defends, saying it makes sense to have a German on the board, given German dependence on Russian gasoline. Büchele chairs the German Committee on Eastern European Economic Relations.
Russia is, at this point in time, the largest energy supplier to Germany. It will stay that way for a long period of time because pipeline gas is not available from that many sources.
Putin biographer Boris Reitschuster says as a German, he finds Schröder's ties to Russia embarrassing and laments its impact.
Germany is hugely Schröderized. Schröderization is a foreign word in Russian language, means corruption of the political elite. And we are very corrupted now by Vladimir Putin, by his money. And that's why we have this atmosphere that we should be good friends with Russia.
Nuripur says what Schröder is doing is a brazen conflict of interest.
Imagine Barack Obama now being, I don't know, a lobbyist for Chinese government in the United States. It would be a damage to the office of the U.S. president. And this is why I think we need other rules in this country for people who are leaving office.
Like Nuripur, many Germans want their senior officials prevented from lobbying or taking jobs that pose a conflict of interest for longer than the current one-year limit. But they don't want Gerhard Schröder to face sanctions like the Ukrainians have suggested. Their reluctance may have to do with the fact many Germans are growing weary of sanctions, which some say is costing Europe economically more than Russia. A recent poll by the conservative daily Die Welt also shows nearly 3 out of every 5 Germans want to improve their country's relationship with Russia. Schröder's office declined NPR's request for an interview with him.
Diejenigen, die jetzt bestimmte Entscheidungen besonders kritisieren.
But last summer, during a campaign event for his Social Democratic Party, Schröder accused those who criticize his Russian ties as having an interest in starting a new Cold War. Soraya Sahardi-Nelson, NPR News, Berlin.
This is Here and Now, and there's a lot of news coming out of Washington today. This morning, House Speaker Paul Ryan said he is not running for re-election. Reporters asked him if the prospect of losing the House to Democrats in the midterm election factored into his decision.
No, none whatsoever, actually. Look, you all know me. I didn't take this job to get the gavel in the first place. I'm not a guy who thinks about it like that. This really was two things. I have accomplished much of what I came here to do, and my kids aren't getting any younger.
And as we noted, President Trump threatened Russia on Twitter, writing, "Russia vows to shoot down any and all missiles fired at Syria. Get ready, Russia, because they will be coming, nice and new and smart." Russia then said they would retaliate. They were reacting to his challenge. But despite that, Trump also tweeted, "Much of the bad blood with Russia is caused by the fake and corrupt Russia investigation," as he weighs whether to fire the men leading that investigation. Let's bring in our strategist, Alice Stewart, the Republican strategist today. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
Good. And Jamal Simmons, the Democratic strategist. Hi, Jamal, to you as well.
Hi, Robin.
And Alice, I want you to start with Paul Ryan, because he was seen as something as a reluctant leader, more the numbers cruncher behind like a tax plan. But this is already being spun everywhere as another Republican bailing for fear they can't win in 2018. And as that gets repeated as it is, it's just being blasted everywhere. More Republicans might follow him. He's their leader. How should Republicans handle this?
Robin, I think the key is, you indicated, people are reading way too much into this. Paul Ryan took over this position from the get-go, acknowledging he has reservations about this. He has small children at home. It would be a huge commitment for him to take over in that position. And he took it over because he realized that he was called to do it, and he realized he was the best person for the job. But when he did it, he was very upfront. Look, I've got personal commitments at home that I want to continue to focus on. I won't be able to put the time in like Boehner did, but he was able to give the time it need. And he also has professional slash political goals, and he wanted to pass meaningful tax reform. He wanted to roll back federal government regulations, and he wanted to raise money for the GOP. All three of those, he checked the box on those. So in my view, go ahead and get out while he's ahead, and then now spend time with the family. So I think reading way too much into it.
Well, you say that they're reading way too much into it, but they are. So, I mean, what if that's the case, that's what they're saying, that he's leaving along with a flock of Republicans, fearful that the Democrats are going to take over and he won't have that leadership position. So are you just saying that Republicans should be saying what you just said?
I would like to think as more comes out on this, they will see that he was true to what he said. He has no regrets. He is proud of the accomplishments that he's made. And the good thing is we have a strong GOP bench behind him. We have Leader McCarthy. We have certainly Scalise. We have Mark Meadows. We have Jim Jordan, a strong cadre of Republicans that can step up to the plate and not only do the job we need in leadership, but to help continue to execute the president's vision and his priorities. And look, Ryan can walk away from this having helped raise $115 million. Mm-hmm. The GOP has more cash on hand than the Democrats, and that's something he should be proud of, and the GOP should thank him for his service and look ahead to the midterm elections.
Okay, Jamal, it's your turn. How are Democrats absorbing the news?
Oh, I think Democrats see this as a big plus and a boon for the chances, and it says something in chances this November. And it says something to every Republican, as you just said, that, you know, if things were great, would Paul Ryan be leaving? And I just don't know that that's true. I think Paul Ryan's legacy here, if we could – let's just assume that what he's saying is true, that he wants to go spend time with his family. But what he's leaving behind a debt and a deficit that will grow to a debt being 96% of GDP by 2028, according to the Congressional Budget Office, just this last week. That's because of tax cuts, and it's because of spending plans the Republican Congress has put in place. I think that is a horrible legacy for somebody who calls himself a fiscal conservative.
So the ball may be in the Democrats' court. Jamal Ryan says he's not retiring because of the atmosphere that Donald Trump brought to Washington. But let's listen to retiring Pennsylvania Republican Charlie Dent, who told CNN what it's like to be a Republican under the president.
There's a lot of weariness and a lot of exhaustion, frankly. This is going to be a challenging year. And I've said this many times that, you know, the litmus test for being a Republican these days is not about any given set of ideals or principles. It's about loyalty to the man And I think that's challenging. And so,
there are now about twice as many Republicans who've said they are not running for re-election than Democrats. So, Jamal, considering that, what does your party have to do to make sure they take this over the finish line? Are they doing the right things?
Don't screw it up.
That's it, period.
I think the most important thing for Democrats to do is to do three things. One, stand up for American values of fairness and justice and opportunity for everybody. Two, let's hold Donald Trump accountable for his corrupt ways. And then three, let's have a plan for how we're going to get more economic opportunity to more Americans faster. If Democrats run on those three things, Democrats will win and will have an agenda to help make the country a better place next January.
Okay, I want to move on to something, Alice, that I want you to take, because the other big question in Washington today is, will President Trump fire Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein? He's, of course, the person who would have to fire FBI Special Counsel Robert Mueller. And this is after, of course, the FBI seized documents from the president's personal attorney, Michael Cohen. I just want to listen to some more sound. This morning, Freedom Caucus Chair, this is, of course, the Conservative Caucus, Mark Meadows, was asked if President Trump is talking about the firings.
I do talk to the president on a regular basis, and I can tell you that he is not talking about firing Bob Mueller. I mean, now, is he very frustrated with the process and the fact that this continues to go on and that there's no evidence of collusion? Certainly.
Alice, what would you recommend here? Because the president seems to be floating this idea. Maybe, you know, it's undecided, and we have a real divide in the Republican Party over whether or not he should.
We do. And Robin, I talked to Congressman Meadows quite often and recently on this. And he, like others that are supportive of the president, they are looking at this from the standpoint that Jeff Sessions and Rosenstein are the ones that are under scrutiny and should be under scrutiny because they should be reining in Mueller and his wide-sweeping probe in the Russia investigation. And they're concerned with Sessions not releasing documents to members of Congress, and they're concerned about Rosenstein not having the president's back more on this investigation. And others feel the same way. I've talked to some that even aren't Trump supporters, that there is a coordinated effort to try and discredit Sessions as well as Rosenstein. However, look, if the president is innocent in this and has done nothing wrong and has no collusion and no coordination, then Robert Mueller is the one and only person that can get to the truth, and the truth will set him free. And in my advice and my thought would be, keep your mouth shut. Let Robert Mueller do his job and get to the bottom of this. Let the investigation play out. And if you haven't done anything wrong, then there's no reason to step up and try and stop this investigation. Yet there are many Republicans in Congress that are trying to make sure and rein in the size and scope of this investigation and try and keep either get Mueller out of there, but certainly keep the investigation more curtailed.
Jamal, this is tricky territory for Democrats in some ways, because if the president does act, as we're talking about the fact that he might, then there's a complicated strategy at play here. How do you handle it? Do you then open the door and start calling for impeachment, which could, in fact, start motivating the president's base and just politicize this whole thing even more?
I think Democrats should call for holding the president accountable. We don't know if that means impeachment yet, but we do know the president needs to be held responsible for his actions. Here is the thing. The Justice Department is treating the Trump Organization and the president as if it is an organized crime family, and they are going after people at every level of it. And now they're at the door of the president's own Tom Hagen consigliere lawyer from The Godfather, Michael Cohen. They're in his home, not just at the door. They're in his home, and they're sifting through his communications. This is unprecedented. And I think forget about jeopardy of the Democrats getting this wrong. It's the jeopardy of the Republicans, who are faced with having to defend a president who has a national security advisor, a personal lawyer, and several other associates either under indictment or having pled guilty.
Jamal, I just want to jump in there and ask Alice about this, because this is what we were talking about, the divide in the party and who he's listening to. On Monday, Fox News host Lou Dobbs said if it were him, he'd fire Mueller in 3 seconds. And this, again, after the FBI took the documents from his lawyer. Let's listen.
Do I overstate it? This looks like an absolute abhorrent breach of everything
that
law and order is supposed to stand for.
Well, the attorney.
And Alice, we understand that the president is listening to many of these conservative voices that are not in Congress, whereas the Republicans in Congress, we keep hearing many of them, John Cornyn and others, saying, do not do this, do not fire him. So why don't the Republicans back the legislation that calls for special protection for any special counsel if fired.
Some of them are. Some of them do want to make sure and protect Robert Mueller.
But they're in charge.
Sure. Well, they want to. They remember what happened with Nixon when he got rid of person overseeing his investigation. That didn't turn out too well for him. And there are major consequences politically for our party if the president does that and demonstrates obstruction of justice. You can get rid of Mueller, but you're not going to get rid of this investigation. It will continue in another way, shape, or form, whether it's the court of special counsel or the court of public opinion. And in my view, protections should be in place for Mueller to continue this investigation, and the president would be a huge mistake if he were trying to get rid of Mueller, Rosenstein, or Sessions. Let the truth, let the facts play out, let
this investigation conclude. It sounds like you're saying they have the power to pass it. They should pass it because it will protect the president as well. It would protect a Republican president from perhaps making a mistake. Alice Stewart.
And the danger is that we end up. The danger is that we end up without having the president making this decision before they get a chance to pass the bill.
That's Jamal Simmons, the Democratic strategist. Alice Stewart, the Republican strategist. If they had everybody's ear, that's what they'd tell them to do. Alice, Jamal, thanks so much.
Have a great
day.
Thank
you. Have a good day.
The Dow opened down nearly 200 points today, and some analysts are pointing to the tweets this morning from President Trump warning Russia to get ready for a missile strike on Syria. Meanwhile, oil prices hit a three-year high because of concern about conflicts in the region. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, walk us through, just remind us, I mean, it seems, you know, obvious, but why and what stocks fall on the potential for a U.S. intervention in Syria?
Yeah, Robin, well, obviously, whenever geopolitical tensions heat up very suddenly like this, there tends to be a, sort of a knee-jerk reaction from investors to just sell stocks. And it's in this case, it was pretty much across the board. When you think of most of the big American companies that dominate the stock market indexes, they are so global in nature that investors can kind of quickly imagine the worst-case scenario where global supply chains are disrupted or global trade is disrupted. But like I said, these are often knee-jerk reactions, which are exactly that, and they can tend to be overreactions.
Well, is it an overreaction or a message? Because we know that investors responded after President Trump talked about tariffs. Nothing, not as much has been implemented yet, and things settled down. So is it more to just send the signal, don't do this?
Well, you know, there's the old cliche, markets hate uncertainty, and it really is true. And you can really see that playing out in real time now. One day we're talking about tariffs on $100 billion worth of goods. The next day it's $200 billion. The next day China's president is kind of easing concerns. So it all sort of fits together in one situation where there is certainly a lot of uncertainty right now in the market. Geopolitics, trade,
Facebook.
Inflation, Facebook.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And tech in general. So, fundamentally, the economy is still doing great. The outlook for corporate profits and earnings is excellent. But this uncertainty is a lot for investors to digest, and it sort of explains why there's so many ups and downs in the market.
And talk a little bit about the tech stocks volatile because of the Facebook questions. I mean, some people are of a certain age are thinking, Ma Bell, might this be broken up? Might there be regulations? What impact is that having?
Well, yeah, there's certainly the risk of further regulations on companies like Facebook, and there's also a risk of just a consumer backlash. People following this in the news, getting upset about their privacy perhaps being violated, and that could have perhaps even a more direct influence on Facebook if people log off the service, stop using it. And it's not just Facebook. I mean, obviously, there are concerns about data privacy across many of the big .com companies. And don't forget, Amazon.com has clearly fallen under the crosshairs of President Trump. So there's uncertainty there, too, as far as can you really trust technology stocks to continue being this engine of growth for the stock market that they've been for the last few years.
By the way, I feel we should say that Ma Bell used to be called the phone company. It was the phone company and had a monopoly over everyone that got to use a phone, and it was broken up.
Right.
Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, with a look at how Wall Street is responding to just all the different spasms that we're hearing, including this morning's tweets from President Trump warning Russia to get ready for missile strikes in Syria. Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Voters in Anchorage, Alaska, rejected a proposal last week that would have banned transgender people from using bathrooms that correspond to their gender identity. The bathroom bill, as it was called, mirrored legislation passed in North Carolina in 2016. Proponents have long said such rules are common sense privacy protections. Critics say they discriminate against transgender people. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports.
For Lillian Lennon, watching the votes being tallied in last week's municipal election was tense.
I, of course, you know, was a little nervous because it was kind of like the final countdown.
Lennon, a transgender woman, is a field organizer for Fair Anchorage, a group that spent more than a year coordinating against what became known as Proposition 1, the bathroom bill. To the surprise of many in Anchorage, including some of the campaign's organizers, the measure failed to pass by just a little over 4,000 votes. Lennon attributes the results to a coalition that included civil rights groups, the business community, and moderate Republicans.
We were able to pull together a really strong trans-centered education campaign, really show the lives of trans people and their families.
Others point to high turnout in the city's first ever election done by mail-in ballots and a popular progressive mayor running for re-election. But not everyone agrees with those explanations.
I would say the number one reason would be $1 million buys a lot of confusion.
Jim Minnery is president of Alaska Family Action, a Christian policy advocacy group. He chaired the campaign in favor of the bathroom bill, but they were outspent by a margin of 6-1. Prop 1 attracted more money than any other item on the Anchorage ballot by far, with donations from progressive groups outside the state flooding in. Minnery says his organization will now focus on electing a more conservative governor and legislators in November who can override Anchorage's local policies.
We're feeling pretty positive about it and just looking forward to another opportunity to bring some common sense back to this issue.
Anchorage's campaign to defeat Proposition 1 may provide a playbook for similar state-level battles. Casey Reynolds is spokesperson for the Alaska chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, one of the main opponents of the local measure.
I would expect the understanding of what happened here to reverberate through the community very quickly because it really was both a local and national effort here in Anchorage.
Voters could see similar state-level measures on the ballot in Montana and Massachusetts this fall. For Here and Now, I'm Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage.
Well, now the story behind the story of hip replacements. More than 370,000 Americans have them every year. They can be a life-changing cure for crippling and painful arthritis. But in the 1970s, a medical complication arose that threatened the future of the procedure. Dr. Bill Harris, who was the chief of joint replacement surgery at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston for 30 years, tried to find out what was going wrong. He's 90 now and author of the new book, Vanishing Bone. Carrie Goldberg from member station WBUR shares his story of medical detective work.
The year was 1974. Surgeons had been performing total hip replacements for more than a decade.
Total hip replacement is an absolutely magnificent operation, and we were able to do remarkable things to restore mobility and relief of pain and the joy of life.
Dr. Bill Harris was sent a mystifying patient, a prominent lawyer from San Francisco whose hip replacement had worked, but now something was going badly awry.
I had never seen anything like this before. The bone around his prosthesis, around his total hip, had been completely destroyed. It was just astonishing. And I thought it had to be cancer.
But under the microscope, there was no cancer, no recognizable disease of any kind. It was something stranger. The area was swarming with immune cells that clear away debris. They were stimulating production of another kind of cell called an osteoclast, which means bone eater.
And it was actively and aggressively eating the bone.
Harris and his colleagues were baffled.
What in the world is this disease and how does it come about? Why is it there?
Before long, this bone-eating disease struck thousands of patients and then hundreds of thousands. The longer people had their replacement hips, the more chance their bones would vanish. Sometimes their bones became so weak, just walking could make them snap. By 1990, this disease, called periprosthetic osteolysis, was the number one cause of total hip replacement surgery failure. As Bill Harris and his colleagues became medical detectives, they focused first on the glue that attaches the artificial hip joint to the patient's own bone. It's called bone cement. Maybe tiny bits of bone cement were causing the bone-eating cells to go on the attack. So Harris and others devised techniques to replace hips without using the bone cement, and they figured they'd solve the problem.
Only to find, when I reviewed my first 100 cases of my own design of a cementless total hip replacement, bingo, the very same disease.
Bad news, but they were on the trail. They realized that the problem wasn't just the glue. Tiny particles of plastic from the artificial hip joint itself were causing the bone to vanish. But why? When Harris and his team examined replacement hips that patients had bequeathed to the lab after their death, they found a major clue.
We found that the actual process of walking had modified the polyethylene.
The hips were made of a special polyethylene plastic. Its molecules are extraordinarily long and narrow. In their usual state, the molecules have no organization. But in the hips of these deceased patients, it looked different.
We found that all of the strands of the polyethylene were lined up in a row. The polyethylene molecules had been changed in their position. They'd been modified by the fact that gait simply goes back and forth and forth and back. And that lines them up.
So the process of walking was restructuring the plastic in a way that made it wear down. And as it wore down, it released those particles that were causing the problem. Dr. Harris turned to his friend Ed Merrill, a professor of polymer chemistry emeritus at MIT. Merrill suggested a process called cross-linking. It connects one strand of the polymer to the next and makes the material more resilient. The team found a way to use an electron beam to cross-link the hip joint plastic. Then they tested the material in a special machine, a hip simulator that had taken them 3 years to perfect.
We could detect nowhere at all, zero wear. We thought it might reduce wear, it might make it better. It made it almost perfect.
Finally, in 1998, the first patient got a hip made of the new, more resilient polyethylene plastic.
And there are probably now 7 million people around the world walking on this material in total hips and in total knees. The disease is virtually gone.
Dr. Harris says the story illustrates how contemporary medical science works, the complexity involved, the collaboration it takes, the persistence it requires. The story also reflects how treating patients can provide extra motivation for doctors to do their own research.
I loved taking care of patients, and I loved going to the operating room. But I also hate failure. And my own failures in the operating room would lead me to say, let's take this failure up to the laboratory and see if we can't unscramble it, unlock it, and find a way to do it better.
At age 90, Bill Harris hasn't needed that better way himself. He's still walking on his own original hips. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
A longtime opponent of the Endangered Species Act has been tapped to fill a key post guiding federal policy on threatened animals. In March, the Interior Secretary named Susan Combs the Acting Assistant Secretary for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, alarming environmental advocates familiar with her career in Texas state politics. Asher Price is an environmental reporter for the Austin American Statesman, and he joins me now from Austin, Texas. Asher, why exactly are environmentalists so worried about Susan Combs?
Well, the thing to know about Susan Combs is that she's a rancher and she approaches endangered species issues as a property rights issue. And while she was in state government here in Texas, she successfully moved power of overseeing endangered species issues from the state Parks and Wildlife Department to her office, which was the state comptroller's office. And that was her way of injecting issues of economic development into endangered species proposals. Endangered species regulations mean habitat protection, and with that means possible curtailing of mining activities, oil and gas activities, subdivision development, all sorts of things. And so she saw it as her mission. She really has a passion for this to halt what she sees as the creeping of the Endangered Species Act and federal overreach on private property rights.
Look, I think it's important to go deeper on that issue. As you have said, she is a rancher herself, and she knows very well what it is like when the federal government steps in to invoke this law. It can disrupt business. It can stop oil or gas or energy development in its tracks. And a lot of people in Texas, a lot of people in the West, actually see very much eye to eye with her on this.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly right. We have a long history of Texas and, of course, other parts of the country on really contentious endangered species issues. She very deliberately went about here in Texas pushing back on these endangered species issues, and she would get money from the state legislature, as much as $10 million, to fund research here in Texas to re-examine the science behind a lot of these species protections.
Talking about some of the specific species that Susan Combs actually fought to remove from protections in Texas.
One of the species that she's tried to delist is a bird called the golden-cheeked warbler, a small bird that nests here in central Texas. And it's been listed as endangered since the 1990s. And she even went so far as pressing military at Fort Hood, a big military installation here in central Texas, to say that habitat protections for the warbler, which nests at Fort Hood among many other places in central Texas, was harming the fight in the war on terror.
Because the military was restricted from doing certain things on the base?
Exactly. There were some training exercises that the military couldn't do during certain times of the year at certain parts of the installation. The installation is tens of thousands of acres big, so there was plenty of other space to do other military work. And my colleague Eric Dexheimer and I found that officials at the installation were saying that it really isn't a problem. Susan Combs and an ally of hers in the administration of George P. Bush, the General Land Office commissioner here, would write emails to the Fort Hood brass and get them to make statements to our newspaper saying that there was a problem, that they couldn't do the training that was necessary. So that just that example shows the kind of political stakes that were involved. And by the way, that ally from George P. Bush's office is now head of the EPA regional office here in Dallas.
So what would her role in the federal government be, and what exactly are environmentalists worried that she will do if she's able to carry out that role?
I think her title is Assistant Acting Secretary for Parks, Fish and Wildlife. And among the agencies she'll oversee is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which carries out endangered species protections. One environmental group we spoke with said this is like putting an arsonist as town fire marshal. They're worried that she'll slow down species protections, maybe pull back on enforcement, and just generally kind of dismember the Endangered Species Act.
You know what's so interesting about this is that it mimics a lot of what we've seen at other federal agencies during the Trump administration. The White House has put people in charge of departments and agencies who are essentially there to dismantle the very work that those agencies are there to do. And I think the most obvious example of that is Scott Pruitt in the EPA, who has long been a fierce critic of the agency who he's now in charge of. Do you see similarities there in Susan Combs' role with the Endangered Species Act?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think there's just broadly a kind of pushback against some of the purposes of federal government. You know, a lot of Trump appointees have come in for criticism as being unprepared for their job. Mm-hmm. That is not the case with Susan Combs. She has thought a lot about this issue, both in and outside of government, pushing for the delisting of species, especially here in Texas.
That's Asher Price, an environmental reporter for the Austin American-Statesman. Asher, thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter.
is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.